You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, April 7th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
Super.
Good. So we're recording the show a bit early this week because this show is going up while we're at Nexus.
I bet we're having such a good time.
Damn right.
Here we are.
You know what we should have done to advertise Nexus is to spam all of our listeners with repeated requests for them to attend Nexus. Hey, speaking of that, happy birthday to Spam. Today, April 12th
really?
Is... Well, kind of. It's as good a birthday as any. Back in 1994 was the biggest commercial spamming operation, like the first big commercial spamming operation that was launched. It was launched by Lawrence Cantor and Martha Siegel, were a married couple who had their own law firm. And on April 12th, 1994, they posted a spam message onto Usenet, which used to be a thing, kids, before the internet as you know it. Yeah, it was, they were advertising a service to help people get green cards, like a green card lottery service. And it was widely condemned. And, it wasn't the first instance of spam. Spam had existed previously. Spam was a word previously used to reference annoying things online. Like the earliest I can figure, it was used on, like in chat rooms and on message boards and things as, you know, you just write the word spam over and over and over and over again to kind of push down other people's messages or push them up. Depending on which way you're going, but to push them off people's screens. And back then it was really, really annoying. So you could drive people out of a chat room by doing that. And of course the word spam was used because it was a reference to the Monty Python sketch in which there's a restaurant and all they serve is spam. And there is a chorus singing spam, spam, spam over and over again, and drowning everything out.
Did they serve eggs and spam?
I think it was just spam. Yeah. So that it was kind of a joke and a kind of trollish thing to do back in the day. And so the lawyers, Cantor and Siegel, became the first well-known commercial operation to annoy the hell out of everyone and try to sell something. They claimed that they got 1,000 new clients from doing this and made $100,000 off of it. Although there's really no... They didn't really present any evidence for that, so who knows? But they did piss off everyone and led to the development of tools that Usenet groups could use to erase that kind of spam and prevent it from happening. So the first spammer arms race basically happened after that.
Yeah.
They went on to try to make more money based on their internet savvy, writing books like How to Make a Fortune on the Information Superhighway, stuff like that.
The heady days of the early 1990s. The pre-bubble bursting.
Yeah. Apparently, they were disbarred back in 97 for their illegal advertising practices. They were apparently at the time they might have been the first law firm to be disciplined like that because of their ad practices. So good job, jerks. Everyone hates you.
So I do have to say that April 12th, is another anniversary.
It was the date that Yuri Gagarin orbited the Earth.
It's also my my wife and my actual anniversary.
Oh, yeah.
Happy anniversary.
April 12th.
Thank you. 1992, so we're older than spam.
You should get a t-shirt that says that.
What's that, 92?
Wow.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Wow, that went by fast.
Wow.
I know.
Gee.
And, of course, we will be at Nexus on our anniversary.
Wow, how romantic.
Which I can tell you,
can't think of a better place.
Yeah, very popular decision in my household. Let me tell you,
your wife is probably the most understanding person in all of skepticism.
There's no probability about it.
It's a scientific fact.
We love you, Joss.
Yeah, happy anniversary,
Joss. Bob. Yeah, thanks for letting him come out and play.
Yeah, basically. All right. Jay, so I hear that the Chili's restaurant got themselves into a little bit of hot water recently.
Yeah, you know, I have to give it to them, though. I think that they did the right thing. I don't think that Chili's actually behaved wrongly. I think once they found out what the deal was, they went in the right direction. But let me tell you what I'm talking about. So the restaurant Chili's had a fundraiser event planned to honor the National Autism Awareness Month. And what they did was they decided to donate 10% of their income on the 7th of March, which was is the day that we're recording this. And they selected an organization called the National Autism Association. And the NAA is based in Attleboro Falls, Massachusetts, in the United States. And their mission.
Sorry.
I used to live near there. So their mission statement on their website is to respond to the most urgent needs of the autism community. Further reading on the National Autism Association's website, however, sends a very different message. This is literally right off their website. Based on parent reports, including parents representing the National Autism Association, sharp regression occurred in the children directly following immunizations.
Right. That's their first line.
That's the very first line that they write on one of the pages on their website. It's not on the homepage, but this is the page that tells you who they are.
Yikes.
While many parents can provide detailed accounts of regression in their children following vaccination, other parents have reported autism in their unvaccinated children. More sparsely, parents report swift regression following an illness, use of antibiotics, and random chemical exposure such as carpet cleaning. Skipping down to the next paragraph, most researchers do agree that environmental factors play a role, though there is no one cause of autism identified by mainstream science. And then skipping down to the next paragraph, a recent review of the world's medical literature suggests that underlying biochemical abnormalities are likely involved in environmental susceptibilities and the development of autism, including mitochondrial dysfunction. So I have to point out something here. One, they start off by saying, based on parents' reports, and then they go on to say how parents that belong to the organization report that their children got autism after vaccinations. They clearly are an anti-vaccination group, yet they quote modern science and research and all that in the next two paragraphs. So they're not even like conforming to their own internal structure, right? Their belief that vaccinations don't work, and then now they're also quoting sites. So in essence, what I'm pointing out here is they're cherry-picking information that suits their needs.
Jay, yeah, they're doing this is the motivated reasoning thing, right? This is, you know, we've talked about this in the context of global warming and other issues where if you give people more information, chances are they're not going to actually change their views. They're just going to incorporate that information into their views. So that's what they're doing here. They're spinning everything. They're emphasizing the environmental factors, downplaying the genetic factors, because that's their agenda. That's they believe. I also wanted to point out, you know, they're talking about parents noticing when autism begins and that it was preceded by something, you know, some random chemical exposure or some illness or some use of antibiotics. So this is a very common phenomenon, you know, when people have a notice the onset of symptoms or some illness, and you think back to like what happened recently that might have triggered this. That's a very common thing to think. You can always come up with something. You know what I mean? Like when is the last 3 months of your life free of anything that could possibly have triggered, especially if your criteria are so broad? Any chemical exposure, any illness.
So the bottom line here is that the internet freaked out. Right? The internet responded to this and they let Chili's know via social media. Many people wrote blogs and were tweeting about it. And, you know, what happened was Chili's heard about it and had a couple of initial responses that were trying to downplay things. But in the end, Chili's, I'm assuming that they realized that they were not following science and that there was some type of disconnect here between what the NAA was saying and what modern science has to say. And Chili's decided to cancel the fundraiser. So here's what Chili's had to say. Chili's is committed to giving back to the communities in which our guests live and work through local and national give back events. While we remain committed to supporting the children and families affected by autism, we are canceling Monday's give back event based on the feedback we heard from our guests. We believe autism awareness continues to be an important cause to our guests and team members, and we will find another way to support this worthy effort in the future, with again our sole intention being to help families affected by autism. So I think that's a fantastic response.
But what I suspect is that Chili's didn't properly vet the National Autism Association. They just assumed by their name or whatever interaction they had with them that they were just supporting families with autism or research into autism. They didn't realize that they were an overtly anti-vaccination group. So they just got caught with their pants down. They didn't vet the group properly. And then when it was brought to their attention, I think they initially tried to do some damage control, and they eventually realized that the only damage control that was going to work was to cancel the event, which is what they ultimately did.
You know, it shows that this type of activism works. It's just unfortunate that it happens to work both ways. In the end, though, I have to give praise to those who were part of this chorus. You know, we had a lot of people that were tweeting over and over again and keeping up with this on a daily basis. And I read on Facebook a couple of days ago, somebody said, you know, please don't purchase anything at Chili's on that Monday, because we, you know, certainly don't want money to be funded to an anti-vaccination group. And, you know, I found that to be a very helpful post, because he wasn't actually saying, you know, Chili's sucks and all this. It was just saying, you know, just don't contribute to the fundraising event.
There are occasional episodes like this where just skeptical activism, you were able to jump on these kind of episodes. Like, Rebecca, I think you discussed one previously where one of the airlines is going to have an anti-vaccination message on there.
And also the AMC theater thing was the biggest.
Yeah, so we gotta keep on top of this stuff, because, you know, who else is going to do it if we don't do it? All right. So speaking of using social media for good or evil.
Yes.
Indiegogo is backing another dubious campaign. We spoke previously about an Indiegogo campaign to, so Indiegogo is a crowdfunding site. Like Kickstarter, I think, is the more popular one that more people know about. But Indiegogo,
right? The difference is Indiegogo will give you any money that you collect. Where Kickstarter, you need to get 100% funded in order to get any of the money.
Yeah, if you recall, they were funding a campaign to create basically a free energy device.
Oh God!
Which is, you know, was completely fraudulent. And I had written Indiegogo. I know you did as well, Jay, and that they were completely unresponsive. They never got back to me. So now they're being criticized for another campaign that they're supporting. And there's this one, the primary reporting has been done by a site called Pando Daily, which actually is like doing the primary investigative journalism on this and doing a good job. This is a campaign for a device called the Gobi by a company called Healbi. And what this is, imagine this, it looks like a wristwatch. You wear it on your wrist. It's about the size of a watch, and it will measure your glucose and also like the water content in your cells. And by doing that, it uses some kind of mysterious algorithm to calculate all of your caloric input and output.
Mysterious, yeah.
It could tell you how many calories you consume and how many calories you burn. Now, of course, that would be a fabulously useful device. Can you imagine, as a dieter, knowing exactly how many calories you consumed and burned
in a
day?
I think I often, when I talk to my friends about dieting, one of the biggest things that seems to set people back is assuming that you're eating a certain number of calories, but then when you actually go to the trouble of, you know, weighing everything you eat, you realize that you're eating substantially more calories than you realize. So something like that would be huge.
Yeah. People underestimate their caloric intake generally. That's correct. And just writing down everything you eat is actually a pretty good technique for losing weight, actually. Mm-hmm. They've raised almost $1 million, this company, for this device.
A million?
Yeah.
$1 million.
Might have passed it by the time the show comes up, but as of our recording, they're at almost $1 million. So what Pando Daily found out is that this company is like a Russian company with a minimal footprint in the U.S., like just whatever they needed to, you know, to run this campaign, and just marketing, really. So it's just a marketing shell around this company in Russia. They have no patents for anything. They've never apparently done any biomedical research. So all very fishy. Indiegogo claims that there were no red flags for this campaign. But then they also claimed that they investigated it and it checked out. So those two things are inconsistent because they wouldn't have investigated it if there were no red flags.
I'm sorry. You said they investigated the device?
The campaign.
Or a device?
The campaign. Just say, yeah, okay. This company's okay. On the up and up. So they do promise on their website that they investigate. This is a quote from their website. Indiegogo has a comprehensive fraud prevention system to protect our users. Campaigns and contributions that have been flagged by our fraud detection system go through a thorough review. If we find fraudulent contributions on your campaign, we may remove them from your campaign. Of course, their elaborate research does not involve detecting complete scientific bullshit, apparently, like free energy devices or these miraculous medical devices. So, all right. What's the plausibility here? What's the probability that this company, this Healbee company, actually produced a wristwatch-sized device that could measure caloric intake and output? At this point in time, it's pretty close to zero. It's not impossible to non-invasively measure blood glucose. This has actually been a research project that's been going on for years. There's lots of companies working on potential technology to do this. And we actually are probably on the brink of commercial devices on the market that can do this. The big market for that, of course, is diabetics. You know, diabetics have to prick their finger to measure their blood glucose. Imagine if you could do it just by clipping something to your earlobe or clipping something on your finger and use a light or whatever in order to tell how much glucose there is in your serum. That would be a huge boon. That would be a huge market. You would make millions of dollars just selling a device just that did nothing but just give you a number of what your blood glucose is, without all the other stuff that they're claiming. So why they wouldn't just market that as a first step is curious, right? There's nothing like that on the market. If they really had that technology, it would be a huge boon. It would be an easy money. They wouldn't have to add all these other complicated components to it. It would seem like an obvious first step. And the fact that they're leapfrogging over that is really suspicious. They're claiming to have leapfrogged over it. So that's one thing. The other thing is, so they're not just measuring glucose, they're using a technique called impedance to measure like the water moving in and out of cells. And this is actually not the best technique for measuring glucose. It's probably not the one that's going to hit the market first. And the devices that use impedance are much bigger than what they're claiming. So they're also claiming, therefore, to have made a pretty significant technological advance in using, you know, wearable impedance technology to measure stuff, you know, in the skin, in the body. But the biggest implausibility here is whatever algorithm they claim to have that can use just water and glucose to calculate your total caloric intake, including any fats and proteins that you eat, and also to calculate how much calories you're burning. I don't know how the hell they're hoping to do that.
Yeah, man, how are they going to do that with a blood test?
Right? I don't know. I mean, it seems like there would need to be a huge paper trail of physiological studies establishing the basic principles here. You know, where's all the proof of concept research showing that you can estimate the first step would be doing blood tests in order to say that with blood tests or with whatever, something, you know, more elaborate, you can somehow estimate through some kind of metabolic measurements, how many calories people are consuming or burning. We don't even have that. But now they're doing it with a little non-invasive wristwatch. So this is, as we've talked about before, when somebody's claiming to be leapfrogging 10 to 20 years ahead without any kind of paper trail or research to show for it, it's bullshit. They're making stuff up. There's just no way this obscure Russian company with no track record has made dozens of breakthroughs to come out with this technology all at once.
Right. And so the issue here is, though, that Indiegogo is not detecting this or seemingly doesn't really care. And they've been contacted about it and they're doing nothing about it.
They clearly do not have any science advisors on their staff.
They have some sort of what they said algorithm they use or a program or something, Steve, you alluded to, some kind of filter mechanism. I don't know. What the heck are they talking about?
You mean Indiegogo?
Where are the scientists? Yeah. Where are the scientists?
Yeah. They have some kind of a fraud detection system.
Yeah. Whatever that means.
Yeah. And that in and of itself sounds kind of like BS to me without any real details. And this, again, this is the second time that we found something. It doesn't mean it's only happened two times, but we've definitely found two, what we would consider to be legitimate scams going on here that are just money-making schemes. And they're not asking for more information. They're not asking for any help or seemingly bringing in any professionals to look deeper into it. They just want to sweep it under the rug. And I hate to say this, but I'm really starting to have a problem with Indiegogo.
It's worse than that. I mean, they've been contacted, and they're blowing it off. You know, they're just saying, oh, yeah, we checked it out. It's fine. Yeah, but, you know, but these claims are scientifically hugely implausible.
Look, they're going to leave people with the impression that, you know, when you're supporting efforts like this, which have the potential to raise a lot of money, you know, money is maybe the motivation behind this. You know, science be damned.
Oh, yeah, huge conflict of interest.
The other question here is, who regulates this? So this company is essentially marketing a medical device. And donors are essentially pre-buying the device. You know, you donate at a certain level, you get one when it's finally in production.
That's an interesting angle, yeah.
Yeah, so I actually contacted the FDA and said, you guys regulate medical devices. Here's a medical device. I gave them the link. Said, what's your jurisdiction here? What's the process? They, you know, this is just today. So they haven't gotten back. I got their generic, we got your email thing, but it's going to take them a couple of days to respond to me. So I might have to do a follow up on the next show. But I just was curious, like, who is regulating? This is a medical device that's being pre-sold, making
claims,
dubious medical claims. And who knows if it's safe, if it's accurate, you know, if people are going to, are diabetics going to use this to dose their insulin, even though it's not being marketed for that purpose? You know, you have to prove that medical devices at least are safe and do what they claim to do, you know? Hmm. So very, very gray area right now in terms of this sort of thing.
So crowdfunding in this way is kind of like the Wild West.
Yeah, it's the Wild West.
Yeah, and it can be tricky to come up with the guidelines, both from the company's standpoint, from Indiegogo's standpoint, because they're almost, in a way, like a social network. You know, what do you do when there's a Facebook page promoting some BS? But of course, they're a bit more than that because they are actually providing the means for these people to get money in a very direct way. And at the same time, if you put too many restrictions on the kind of content you can put on there, you know, you could easily sink the entire thing. It could get to the point where they just wouldn't be able to handle the kind of investigations they would have to do in order to constantly protect consumers, you know?
No, but they could reach out to people who do have experience in detecting fraud. I can think of a few organizations that have many decades of being able to do that and ask them for their opinion. I mean, what does that take? A half hour?
How many, you know, cross the threshold of, you know, oh, we need to investigate this. You know, I wouldn't think there'd be a huge percentage that would require this
type
of
vetting. I mean, you're talking about, well, first of all, who decides if it requires vetting or not? You know, you need someone to vet what needs to be vetted.
Indiegogo claims they have that in place, that they're already doing.
You have multiple layers. You have a very superficial initial layer that's just scooping out all the obviously safe ones where there isn't aren't any issues. Ones where, like, there's a core scientific claim or a medical claim or something like that, they need closer scrutiny. They need the next layer. And then maybe you have this final layer where you do a detailed. That's not a big deal. I think, you know, I agree. I think most of these would be, with a very little attention, will be able to pass.
Yeah, and the least that they can do is look into the ones that they're getting emails like this about.
That's right. I mean, they say that they let their users crowdsource the validity of the campaigns. Okay, but part of that is also the feedback that you get. You know, it's, so let that be part of the crowdsourcing. If the internet, you know, is telling you that this is dubious, that should trigger a serious investigation.
Yeah, this is actually, I thought, fairly big astronomy news. I think its real significance, though, may have fallen between the cracks a bit. But essentially, astronomers have likely found an immense body of water under the ice on Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn. Now, this could actually mean that the moon not only could have life swimming in it, potentially, but it could actually be our best chance at finding life elsewhere in the universe or elsewhere in our solar system, better than even Europa, which has kind of been like the gold standard.
What?
Yeah, well, listen. All right, listen. So,
don't you diss your ropa, Bob?
I'm not dissing. I'm just saying it might have been eclipsed a little bit. You can read about this in the most recent edition of the journal Science. Luciano Less of Sapienza University of Rome is the paper's lead author. So this little adventure started in 2005 when NASA's Cassini probe flew past Enceladus and discovered these amazing geysers of sorts spewing water into space from its south pole. Now, I guess they're not technically geysers. They call them tiger stripes. The fractures in the ice are called tiger stripes. So when you see these geysers, I'll call them geysers, when you see them on another world, I mean, it's pretty easy to think, oh, wow, you know, there must be an ocean under there and maybe there's life too. But that's of course, jumping a huge gun, I think. You know, there could be a lot of mechanisms for geysers that don't include a huge subsurface ocean. So how do we find out? So, and this is where the science gets pretty cool. So Cassini did some recent flybys in 2010 and 2012, and they got really close, about 100 kilometers to the surface. So while it was in orbit, NASA's deep space network of these giant antennas, they were receiving radio signals from the probe that made it possible to determine very minute changes in the probe speed, as small as a few millimeters a second. So this is, of course, due to our friend the Doppler effect, which stretches out and compresses light depending if the emitter is moving away or towards the receiver. And you can glean a lot of information from that. So the goal was to determine how the gravity of Enceladus affected Cassini's velocity. But there's lots of things that could be responsible for changes that are just so minute. So they had to subtract those out. And those are things like, you know, perhaps the friction of the friction from the probe hitting the vapor from the geysers that could slow the probe down. Even pressure from the light the solar wind on the probe itself. Even that was calculated and subtracted out. So once you subtract out all the usual suspects, what you have left is essentially the gravitational impact of Enceladus on the probe's movement. So the data was so fine-grained that they actually built up this really nice map, a gravitational map of the pull of the various regions of the moon based on how it affected the movement of the probe. So more gravity in one area essentially means that it's denser there. So that's an easy, very easy conclusion. So the scientists knew beforehand that there was this depression in the South Pole. So they expected to find what they call a negative mass anomaly. And all that means is that there's less matter in a specific location than you would expect if you assume a very uniform distribution of matter. So, you know, if you have a big depression on a moon-sized object, then that could easily create this kind of negative mass anomaly. The total gravitational pull in that area, though, wasn't as small as you would expect, though, from the size of this depression. But that makes total sense, too, because it's very common on planets to find a mass anomaly on the surface that's kind of balanced out by the opposite mass anomaly deeper down. So when they did their calculations, they discovered that the mass of the material under the depression had to be more dense than ice, but less dense than rock. Ta-da! There you go. Water is the perfect candidate. The overwhelming likelihood is that it is water. No, I added that totally on my own.
Ad-libbed? Okay.
I mean, that's it. That's how they determined that there was water under there. But the next puzzle, though, was how could such a cold, tiny planet have liquid water? This didn't seem too difficult to me. Tidal heating seems kind of obvious. Imagine Enceladus stopped in space near Saturn. Now, Enceladus experiences a stronger gravitational force on its near side and a weaker force on its far side, right? I mean, that's what a tidal force is. Now, move the moon around Saturn in its eccentric orbit, and these forces change across the moon, stretching and kneading the entire mass of the moon. So this friction, this tidal friction creates heating, and that could easily account for any of the water that's there. So that's not much of a puzzle anymore. So it looks like we've got a lot of water there. It could be as big as Lake Superior, maybe even bigger. So why, Steve, is this the best candidate for extraterrestrial life? Well, there's two other really good reasons. One is that the water is likely in contact with the rock core of Enceladus, and that's very important because that means that certain key elements for life, like potassium, phosphorus, sulfur, they could easily spread or leach from the core into the ocean. And then finally, they've actually discovered organic molecules in the vapor plumes from the tiger stripes. So you put all that together. I mean, yeah, sure, we know there's an ocean of water, a bigger one under Europa, but we're really not sure what's down there. It's not like we really have any samples, but we actually do kind of know already that there's organic molecules in the vapor coming out from down below.
And so Bob, what are you saying? I mean, are there aliens in that water or what?
That's a good question. So I think I agree with astrobiologist Chris McKay. He said there are now several lines of evidence, the geysers, the plume chemistry, and now gravity, that indicate a substantial body of liquid water. For astrobiology, this is confirmation of what we expect and is good news. My one view is that Enceladus should be the priority. So what we should do, and McKay agrees with this, he says that we should, not in these words, but we should get our butts to Enceladus, get your ass to Mars, and get samples from the plumes and bring them back.
Who was the guy that said that?
This is McKay. McKay agrees.
Okay.
So we got to get there. We got to get these organic molecules, bring them back, and do a deep dive and see if we can find unique biomarkers or something that could remove any doubt. I mean, we could be almost positive if we got our hands on these that life created these biomarkers. And if that happens, well, you know, then we would finally know of life on another planet or moon in this case. And I think if we knew that, I think we would mount an epic mission to Enceladus in record time to actually go there and find this life.
Yeah, and if you go to Europa, we'd have to find some place to drill all the way through.
And we could spend billions doing that. We could drill down and we can find squat.
Yeah, let's just do both. We'll
all right,
our bets.
I'll go with that.
So Rebecca,
yes,
can you tell how smart somebody is just by looking at them?
No,
no.
Very good question, Steve, and I would love to elaborate. There was a paper that was just published from researchers in the Czech Republic, and the title is Perceived Intelligence is Associated with Measured Intelligence in Men but Not Women. So that sound you hear is a can of worms exploding. The researchers took photos of 40 men and 40 women with a neutral expression on a white background, and they had each of those people take a battery of tests that would rate their intelligence in a number of different ways, like general knowledge, their memory, verbal, mathematics, abstract thinking. Then they showed the photos of those people to 160 other people, and they rated each photo for either how attractive they thought the person in the photo was or how intelligent they thought the person in the photo was. And then they crunched the data. So here's what they found. They found that people were more likely to perceive that attractive people are intelligent. So the better looking they found someone, the smarter they assumed they must be. The researchers found that there were several aspects of a person's face that could lead a rater to consider them intelligent. And those sort of combined to make the stereotypical idea of what a smart person looks like. And
yeah, I was going to say, think of any Disney movie with a smart character.
Yeah.
And there you go.
So a narrow face, a thin chin, a prolonged nose, more distance between the eyebrows. And they found, you know, the opposite for stereotypical people of lower intelligence. So a wider face.
So basically Snape.
Would be intelligent. I don't know if there's a Harry Potter equivalent to someone of low intelligence, but
Hagrid, maybe?
Oh, yeah. He's kind of like he's the big guy, right? So yeah, like picture an enormous chin, eyebrows close together. The researchers also found that there was no correlation between any particular facial feature and actual intelligence. So that stereotypical view of an intelligent person, it does not actually represent what an intelligent person necessarily looks like. And there also was no actual correlation between perceived attractiveness and actual intelligence. So it's not that the better looking you are, the more likely you are to be intelligent. And this goes against some previous studies, and the researchers in question mentioned that. And this was like my first red flag that maybe these researchers weren't as scientifically rigorous as one would hope, because they cited Satoshi Kanazawa, who is a horrific, bigoted, sloppy evolutionary psychologist who basically uses pseudoscience to validate his horribly sexist and racist opinions. Like, black women are objectively ugly, uglier than white women. That's like literally one of his studies. And so the researchers of this paper actually did cite him, but on the other hand, he is cited as someone whose research is being rebutted by this study. The final result I will talk about of the Czech study is that when the researchers controlled for attractiveness, people were more likely to consider intelligent people intelligent, provided that the person in the photo was male. So basically, based on the photos, people stood a pretty good chance of spotting an intelligent man, but not of spotting an intelligent woman. And the researchers give a few guesses as to why that is, and some of their guesses make sense. Some of them maybe don't. One is they think maybe women are judged so often by their attractiveness that that could be throwing off the numbers, even though they attempted to control for attraction. On the other hand, they suggest that it's this weird sort of confusing possibility based on women preferring highly intelligent men during some phases of their menstrual cycles and low intelligence men at other times.
When are those times?
Well, that's the thing. You know, they make like this blanket statement that it is known that while in the fertile phase of cycle, women prefer creative intelligence, but it's not known. There are some studies that suggest that that could be true, but those studies tend to be very controversial and really difficult to reproduce. And also, that sort of idea would require men to have evolved a certain trait that broadcast their intelligence, but that women not only did not evolve that, but they would have had to have a specific reason to not evolve that trait. Like, it would have had to have some sort of horrible consequence for women to have had that trait, but men to have kept it. So it's bizarre, and there's really no evidence to back it up. And I just wanted to mention that this study was brought to my attention by my friend Jamie Bernstein, who is a statistician who writes for Skeptic. And Jamie pointed out a few interesting things to me that I would have missed otherwise. She said that when you look at the charts that the study provides, she found that people were best at identifying those with the lowest intelligence. And overall, the men tended to score lower on those intelligence tests than women, which actually makes it kind of difficult to tell if there's a substantial difference between our evaluations of men and women's intelligence. If we're only really good at evaluating people's pictures who have lower intelligence, but it's all men who have lower intelligence, then that really doesn't tell us very much. Also, Jamie pointed out that most people did tend to rate women on the extremes of either very intelligent or very unintelligent, while men were rated closer to their actual IQs and filling in those gaps in the middle. She also pointed out that the older a man was, the more he was perceived as intelligent, but the same was not true for women. And to me, all of that together points to a much more simple explanation, which is that we value and we have certain assumptions about men that we do not have about women. And those assumptions impact how intelligent we think people are. And Jamie also noted one last important aspect of the study that I wanted to mention, which is that the correlation between perceived attractiveness and perceived intelligence was much stronger than the correlation between perceived intelligence and actual intelligence. So, in other words, according to the study, individuals in the real world are absolutely useless about telling whether or not a person is intelligent based on looks alone, because that person's attractiveness completely blinds us. So we might have some ability to pick up on intelligence just by looking at someone, but the fact that we are human and we are more interested in how attractive they are completely overwhelms that.
That was a good summary. I don't know that we could tell much from this study, honestly. I mean, I think you're taking the results at face value.
Yeah. I mean,
and even then, you're right. I think there's not much you could say except that people think better looking people are more intelligent. I think that's the one clear signal there, and that's in line with previous research. My big problem with this is that the researchers were looking for all kinds of correlations. They were doing all kinds of statistical analyses. It just screams of p-hacking to me. And I don't know that they made adjustments for doing multiple comparisons, and essentially their study is reduced to a preliminary hunt for possible correlations. And anything this a study like this finds would need to be verified with an independent data set before I would even take it seriously, to be honest.
Yeah, and there are other issues that I didn't mention, like, you know, it's a small sample size. Which I didn't mention the sample size, but it is worth pointing out that it's not very big.
Not for what they're doing, yeah.
And also, like pretty much all psychology studies, I'm probably going to get an angry letter about that, but like a ridiculously large number of these studies, this was done on college students. And the researchers actually did not include data on the backgrounds and races of the people in the study, which surprised me because I think that's actually quite relevant when you're talking about attractiveness and things, but okay. It was done in the Czech Republic though, so I mean maybe we can assume that it was predominantly white. It's a fair assumption, I think, but we can't say for sure. But we do know that these were all of the people who had their photos taken were all biology students who were in their late teens, early 20s, and all of the people who were rating them were also students. Really, at the end of the day, when we talk about those results, the best we can say is that this study shows what college students think, you know, which, again, you can say about a surprisingly large number of studies, but it is worth keeping in mind.
Yeah, this is, you know, this was like throw a whole bunch of shit against the wall and see what sticks kind of study.
Is that the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, maybe?
No, I don't think so. That's when whatever you find is significant. You know what I mean? That's when you draw the target after you shoot the hole in the side of the barn.
I love that.
But that's deciding your criteria after you see what the results are, whereas they were just looking for every kind of correlation and then showing a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't really make sense. All right, Evan, it's that time again for Who's That Noisy?
Thanks, Steve. I'll start by playing for you last week's Noisy. Here we go.
What is Event Horizon?
What is Event Horizon?
Well, that was phrased in the form of a question.
It was, and a lot of people did pick up on that, that was apparently an answer to a Jeopardy question, which it was, but who or what, in this case, answered that question? Well, we've talked about it many times on the show before. That was, of course, Watson, the IBM supercomputer.
No relation.
And actually has been used one time before as a noisy, but back by popular demand, once again, people want more Watson, apparently.
Did he win that round, Ev?
Oh, yeah. No, did he win? Watson is, as impressive as it is, and for those of you who don't know, it's an artificially intelligent computer system capable of answering questions posed in natural language. And like I said, it was developed by IBM, and it had a nice demonstration playing Jeopardy, and it competed against former winners Brad Rutter and Ken Jennings, and Watson received the first prize of $1 million. So the computer won the day for that one. It does not make the list of the top 500 supercomputers in the world.
You mean in terms of raw power?
In terms of raw power, right. In terms of its
floating point operations.
Right, or flops, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it an artificial intelligence either. It's more, I don't know, I think more of an advanced expert system, I think, might be a little bit more accurate than AI.
Yeah, but that's still considered AI, Bob. I mean, in the computer biz, they use the term AI to refer to things like expert systems. It's not just, it doesn't imply self-awareness or anything like that.
Well, it's clearly not an AGI, artificial general intelligence. I'll leave it at that then.
Yeah.
It can just look up lots of things really fast. The equivalent
really fast,
of a million
right.
books per second. That's
whoa.
That's how fast it can process.
Oh my God.
80 teraflops of raw power.
What's amazing is that a human could do even halfway decent against it.
Yeah.
Think about how good our brains are that we have such a massive parallel processor that we can actually, you know, the best of us can stand toe-to-toe with a system like that.
And we use much less power than a computer
uses.
You rate us by hamburgers, Ev, not by power.
That is – oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. Well, except Rebecca, it would be veggie burgers. Mm-hmm. But I forget – you know, she is a Watson too. And for those of you who are wondering, the National Supercomputing Center in Guangzhou in China in 2013 performed – calculations at 33.863 petaflops.
Petaflops.
Petaflops. So that has the record. fastest to go. So
33 petas.
And the next is a Cray computer at 17.5. So Cray's got some catching up to do.
So you're saying that Watson is cray cray?
No, Watson's a pedophile.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I can't riff on that.
Allison Edwards, congratulations! You were the one winner selected. There were many who answered correctly, but Allison, you're the winner this week. So congratulations on your win. And who's that noisy? We'll maybe see you at the end of the year for the final drawing. And now we'll go ahead and play for you the brand new, fresh off the presses, Who's That Noisy? Yeah.
Very interesting.
That is interesting. I'll give a little hint here. All right. A solution is, will help you figure out the answer to this. So, go ahead and tell us what you think the answer is to that noisy. Who's that noisy's email is WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Go ahead and send us your answers there while we are, working on getting the, forums back up and online. We'll be promoting that again soon, but in the meantime, go ahead and send us your answer via email and good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan. All right, I think we'll have time for a couple of emails this week. This first one comes from Brandon Scalican from Fort Eustis, Virginia. And Brandon writes, I've listened to every show. I'm a wild skeptic in all things science and even in religion. Be forewarned, I am a Christian who believes in science. I have a 17-year ongoing discussion with my cousin, a young earther, about evolution. I'm for the science, him, not so much. Anywho, there is a case, the Justina case in Massachusetts, of a young woman, 15 years old, getting taken from her family because the doctors at Harvard, Massachusetts General, wanted to prove that mitochondrial disease is not real. It was all in the mind. I will send you a link. Is this an overreach of the institution to attempt to prove medical practices, or is this out-of-control government? I know you're not a political show, but this case seriously disturbs me as a father. I don't believe in faith healing, magic, or miracles, but if I disagree with my doctor, will I have my child taken by the state? Your thoughts are welcome. This is the Justina Pelletier case. So this is it's a young girl, 15-year-old girl, actually lives in West Hartford, Connecticut, who developed some symptoms of GI upset and weakness and fatigue and headaches, was diagnosed actually at Tufts Medical Center as having a mitochondrial disorder, and then was taken to Massachusetts General, Mass General, for a second opinion. And there, they thought she had a very different diagnosis. They thought she had a diagnosis of medical abuse by the parents, that her symptoms were psychological. And she has essentially been a ward of the state and locked in a psychiatric ward for the last year at Mass General. The parents do not have custody of her and have had only limited contact with her. And just recently, just a couple weeks ago, at the end of March, the judge in this case granted permanent custody of her to the State Department of Children and Families. So she's essentially will be a ward of the state until she's 18 years old, unless that decision is overturned. Very interesting case. I actually have not written or commented about this before because it is a horrifically complicated case. And I have no firsthand information. The problem is most of the information that we're getting is coming from Justina's parents and her lawyers, the parents' lawyers. The hospital, Mass General, can't say a peep because this is a patient. And patient confidentiality means they can't discuss the case. So we're not getting their side of the story. But here's the medical background. Again, I don't know what her diagnosis is. I don't know what the real story is. Mitochondrial disorders are a category of diseases that are due mainly to genetic problems with the mitochondrial genes that are necessary for the functioning of mitochondria. Mitochondria are the little energy factories inside every cell. A number of the mitochondrial disorders are neuromuscular diseases, and that is my subspecialty. So I have actually treated mitochondrial disorders before, the ones that have neuromuscular manifestations. But they could also present with non-neuromuscular manifestations like, you know, headaches and fatigue and poor energy, etc. They're not controversial when you have a full-blown syndrome and a positive genetic test. The tricky part is in the vague presentations, like, you know, headaches and fatigue and GI upset. Doesn't get more vague than that in terms of a clinical presentation. So if somebody's just presenting with those symptoms, you can't diagnose them as having a mitochondrial disorder based upon just based upon those symptoms. You can do a muscle biopsy, and a muscle biopsy will often reveal very specific changes that can establish the diagnosis of mitochondrial disease. And of course, if you know the specific syndrome, you can do genetic testing. And there are also metabolic tests, you know, blood tests that might show markers of mitochondrial disease. Justina was diagnosed at Tufts by Dr. Mark Corson, who is a pediatrician with a specialty in the genetics of metabolism. And he is apparently, again, this is just on secondhand information. Apparently his diagnosis was mainly clinical. He elected not to do a muscle biopsy because it's an invasive procedure and some patients with mitochondrial disorders don't deal well with anesthesia. So he just made the diagnosis clinically. The doctors at Mass General disagree with the diagnosis. They do not think that Justina has a mitochondrial disorder. They, you know, from, again, secondhand reports, she still hasn't had a muscle biopsy, but the blood tests did not show signs of mitochondrial disease. And they believe that she is a victim of medical abuse. So medical abuse is like Munchausen by proxy, which itself is a horrifically complicated entity to deal with, because the problem is that you can easily get into confirmation bias, where once you think you're dealing with a case of Munchausen by proxy, it's easy to interpret everything as consistent with that. You know, unless you catch parents doing something red-handed, you know, it could easily become a witch hunt, where no matter what happens, you interpret it as consistent with that. If there's no evidence, that's because the parents are really good at it, you know, that sort of thing. They're very clever, you know, crazy people. The one big test is that when you remove the child from the parents, you know, they do better. And also that their anxiety decreases, because that could be a subjective call. You know, if the child is really anxious around the parent who's doing it, and then they're much less anxious when the parent leaves, that apparently is a sign. So again, I don't have firsthand reports from Mass General because they're not releasing information, but apparently they came to believe rather confidently that Justina was a victim of medical abuse and that she did not have a mitochondrial disorder. The parents obviously didn't like that diagnosis. They wanted to bring her back to Tufts, and that's where the legal battle ensued. Now, of course, the treatment for medical abuse is removing the child from the parents. 1 in 10 children who are a victim of medical abuse die at the hands of their parents. So the stakes are pretty high. It's not like they could just, you know, release the kid back to his parents without and not worry about it. If, of course, she really has a mitochondrial disease and is not the victim of medical abuse, then she's not getting treated for that. She's getting inappropriately treated, you know, as a psychiatric patient, essentially, and she's being inappropriately kept from her parents. So the stakes are really high that way, too. So it'd be really nice to know what her actual diagnosis is. And apparently, there was, you know, this is the information that was reviewed by the court, and they decided, they sided with Mass General. They agreed with their assessment of what was the best thing for Justina. I have no firsthand information to second guess that decision. So that's where we have it. So this is a very unusual case. This is not a simple matter of just disagreeing with the doctors or of overreach. It's not just that the doctors at Mass General disagree with the parents. It's that their diagnosis is medical abuse, and that requires removing the child from the parents. That's a very specific situation. It would be hard for me to imagine, and this is my bias as a physician coming in now, I freely admit that, just would be hard for me to imagine a high profile case like this getting national attention. Mass General is under massive criticism from the, you know, the Free Justina crowd. that I can't imagine they have, this has not been thoroughly independently reviewed. And, you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like this is one doctor who could be controlling this case. I mean, I can imagine this sort of thing happening. You know, you'd get the ethics committee involved. There would be committees of doctors. You'd get second, third, fourth opinions. You know what I mean? I mean, as many people as you could get involved to try to make sure that the right thing was being done here would be involved. And Mass General is freaking Mass General. This is not some podunk hospital in the middle of nowhere. This is a world-class hospital. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's bizarre. You know, there are many problems with both our healthcare system and with systems in place to protect children. But generally, I feel like those problems skew in the opposite direction, in the direction of allowing kids to remain in abusive homes as opposed to getting them out of those kind of situations in time to actually save them. So, yeah, like you said, the conspiracy would have to be vast at this point to, you know, to argue that this kid has been taken from their family with no justification.
Or, you know, conspiracy or just a massive failure on the part of many, many people. Again, I could believe that such a failure can occur in isolated cases, you know, but not a case. It's harder for me to believe it because of the attention this case is getting and because of the quality of the hospital. Interesting case. All right. One more email and then we're going to go on to science or fiction. Evan, you looked into this one. Let me read the email. This one comes from Rob Cameron and he writes, granted, I haven't actually done this experiment, but damn, it seems like a scam. Supposedly, if you hold your car remote to your head, the water in your brain amplifies the signal. If the apparent effect is real, I'm guessing it's just the angle that you hold the remote at, either pointed at the car or held to the side. Interesting. So, Evan, you did do this experiment yourself, didn't you?
I actually did.
Tell us what you did.
All right. Well, I'll set it up for you first, and I'll tell you how it all went. So there's this video, and it's a rather pleasant-sounding British man doing an experiment. He's holding the wireless key remote locking mechanism that we use every day with our cars, right? At least those of us that have cars. You have one of these. It's either a fob on your keychain, and some keys actually have this mechanism built right into the key blade itself. He's explaining to the audience that while there is a limited range at which the remote locking and unlocking mechanism will work, you can extend the range if you hold the keyless remote up to your head. He proceeds to do the experiment. He walks about 20 paces away from his car, right? He uses the remote at a normal sort of stance. It's working. He goes another 15 paces and all of a sudden it doesn't work. Okay. He says that the reason for this what he does next is that he holds the key up to his head, like presses it right against the side of his head and presses the button and miraculously there it goes. It works. So, and he says that the reason it works is because everyone's brain is full of water. The water extends the range even further. The water that's in and around your brain. He explains it like this. The waves that are generated from the radio transmitter in your key are added to the waves that are naturally propagating in your head through the water and they add together. Apparently, they are additive, and that will extend the range. And to further his point, he actually held out a plastic jug of water and apparently achieved an even greater range than when he just had held it up to his melon. And, you know, it was kind of sloppily done, if you ask me, but in any case, that was the results he came with. So, you know, there's lots of people on the internet who frankly disagree with this fellow, and of course, I had to put it to the test. Myself, I parked my car at the end of a long parking lot, and there were a few other cars in sight kind of scattered around. There were a few brick and concrete buildings in the area and some metal garbage bins, so that gives you and a couple of trees scattered about. But I always had a direct line of sight to the car, so that gives you an idea of the environment I was in. I would maintain sight with the car at all times, and it was on a level surface, okay, not up a hill, down a hill, or anything like that. I walked 65 paces away from my car before my key lock remote would stop working by itself in a normal position, which is roughly waist high. You know, you just kind of hold your hand out a little bit and you point the key towards or the fob towards your car, normal position. I pressed the button 10 times, right? And nothing happened. So then I held the key up to the side of my head. And after pressing the button for the third time, it worked. I backed up to 75 paces from the car. I tried the normal position again, pressed it 10 times. I didn't get anything. I held it up to my head. And on the seventh time that I pressed the button, it worked. Okay. So I repeated this process 10 paces at a time. And I got a fluke at 85 paces on the second pressing with, in the normal position, it actually worked. And then I held it to my head and got it to work on the first one. So I don't know if other environmental factors were at play there, but in any case, I got all the way back to 115 paces away from my car where nothing worked at the normal position or up to my head. Didn't work at all. Okay. Now, if I were satisfied with that result, I'd probably be in the camp as this English fellow and say that, yeah, this is legitimate. This works. However, I read a little bit more about this phenomenon and I went back and did the experiment again. I changed things up this time though. I brought a stepladder with me. I started at the 65 pace mark. You know, that's where the remote stopped working the first time in the normal position. And again, didn't work. Held it up to my head. I got it to work after a few presses. And then I got up on the ladder, which elevated me 3 feet off the ground, 36 inches higher than I was, and I held my hand in the normal position. And it worked on the first click. Boom. So I went to 75 paces, and I did the whole process again. Instead of just going at normal height and to my head, I also got up on the ladder, or the stepladder, to see what would happen. I went to the 115 pace mark. That's where it would not work either at the normal position or against my head. I got on the ladder, and it took 2 clicks, and it worked. And this continued to work. Every 10 paces, I moved backwards, up to 165 paces. At that point, on the ladder in the normal position, it would not work. Okay, so my unscientific, unblinded experiment yielded these results, that height seems to count. And I'd argue that it's not the fluid in my head amplifying the signal, but rather it's the height at which I held my key at the dictate that dictated the range.
All right. Well, good work, Evan. You're a little mini Mythbuster.
Hey, I like that.
All right. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this?
Yes.
Year, for this week?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Rebecca hopes there's a theme this week.
God, I hope so.
There is no theme this week. I'm sorry, Rebecca.
Deflation.
But we do have 3 interesting items. And here they are. Item number 1. Scientists finally resolved a 120-year-old controversy over the purpose of a zebra's stripes. They are used for temperature regulation. Item number 2, a new study finds that for adolescents, popularity increases the risk of being bullied. And item number 3, scientists have created a computer vision system that can distinguish real versus faked expressions of pain much better than human subjects. Bob, go first.
Okay, 120-year-old controversy, purpose of zebra stripes, temperature regulation. That doesn't sound quite right to me. I mean, the one that I've heard years ago was that it was, you know, if you're chasing, what do you call a group of zebra?
Herd.
Probably a herd.
don't they have a special one, you know, like a murder of crow?
A zebra
or
herd.
Army of ants.
A zebra herd. So a predator chasing them, it's harder to pick one out because the stripes, you know, kind of confuse the predator. I don't know about that one. Popularity increases the risk of being bullied. That doesn't make a lot of sense either, because I would think, you know, why would you bully somebody popular? Because then you'd have a lot of his friends automatically mad at you. So that's kind of odd as well. Oh boy, not doing well here. Let's see, computer vision system, distinguish real versus faked expressions of pain. Yeah, I could buy this. This is a subset of vision that I could see a computer just kicking our butts in, especially with, you know, real and faked expressions there are key differences that a computer can zoom in on in terms of, you know, what kind of muscles are you really contracting? I can kind of see that one. The other two though, not as much. The temperature regulation with the stripes though, that doesn't seem right to me. I'm not sure how stripes would really help with that. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so this whole thing about the stripes, I agree with Bob. I've read the same thing, that when, you know, a bunch of zebras are running around together, that you can't really, a herd of zebra run around, that you can't distinguish how many there are and where does one begin and the other ends type of deal, and it helps with predators. That seems to be believed. I also think that, did I read this? I don't remember, but I think that there's something to do, it keeps insects away from them. Okay, so the next one here, a new study finds that the one about the adolescents, The popularity. Wow, that's interesting. All right, let's think about that one. So, okay, so you have these popular people. I would say, sure, I think this one's science just because they're more in the public eye, more people know about them, and that would therefore would increase, you know, jealousy and all that stuff in adolescence. So that one seems to make sense. And this final one about the computer vision, I could see that too. I mean, I could see the computer would be able to pick up the difference, but I mean, does it mean that it could look at someone that it hasn't gotten a baseline on? I'm going to GWB. I'll just go with Bob. I can't decide on that one.
Always smart.
Okay. I'll go with Bob.
Okay, Rebecca?
And for the record, it's a herd of zebra or a zeal or a dazzle of zebra.
Wow.
Dazzle.
It's fantastic.
Razzle, dazzle.
Okay, anyway, Jane, answer to your question, I have too heard about flies being repelled by stripes. I had a children's book once that suggested wearing stripey shirts in order to repel gnats. They also had some ideas about wearing green and being left-handed, but I'm not sure. I tried all of them and didn't find any difference. But yeah, I do think that is a theory, and I'm just going to say that I agree with pretty much everything that has already been said. Temperature regulation, I don't think I've ever read any compelling arguments in favor of that. I think it's more likely to be either the bug thing, because flies are a big problem, you know, especially if they're carrying diseases. Yeah, that or hiding from predators. So I'm going to say the zebra one's fiction.
And Devin.
Look, I'm obviously in the company of three zebra experts, and whereas I am not, I'm inclined to go with them. It's the zebra one. That's the fiction.
Okay, so you guys are all in agreement again.
Yep, we're all leaning on the same side of the boat. Will it tip over into the ocean, or?
Hey, Steve, you've never done this before. Can you roll a die and randomly select which one you read first?
Okay. The first one, the one you guys chose.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So we'll go right for the money, since Jay requested I roll a randomization device. Item number one, scientists finally resolved a 120-year-old controversy over the purpose of a zebra's stripes. They are used for temperature regulation. You guys all think this one is fiction? So you guys think this one's totally fake, but when in fact, 120 years ago, Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace had a debate over the many hypotheses for the zebra's stripes. The controversy has not really been resolved since then. Here are five hypotheses for what the zebra stripes are for. One is a form of camouflage. Two, disrupting predatory attack by visually confusing the carnivores. Three, a mechanism of heat management. Four, having a social function. And five, avoiding ectoparasite attacks such as from biting flies. So those are the five leading hypotheses. And you guys are saying it's not heat management. You're confident of that. And I've heard a couple of you say maybe the predatory attack. Jay and Rebecca said maybe the biting flies. No one really said camouflage or social function. All right, so this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, ah. My God.
All right,
God.
So put your nickel down on which one the other four you think it was. Just one. Pick one.
Flies.
Ethan. Flies.
Flies.
I'm not saying flies.
Jay says not flies. It's the flies.
Sure.
What they did was they correlated like where the zebras are and the locations where there would be the most biting insects. And that was the test of the hypothesis. And if the biting insect hypothesis is true, then we would expect that zebras have a particular need for such a defense mechanism. So their territories must be in high fly biting regions. And that's what they found. So that's interesting. What they don't know is why flies, biting flies, avoid black and white stripes. They don't know that.
Seems pretty obvious.
Yeah.
I can't tell you why.
Totally obvious. All right, let's go on number two. A new study finds that for adolescents, popularity increases the risk of being bullied. This one, of course, is science. This is based on a survey by Ferris et al. And they looked at adolescents in they basically stratified them according to their social hierarchy. And there was a positive correlation between between being higher up the social ladder and the likelihood of being victimized by his or her peers, which was surprising. That doesn't mean that outcasts are not bullied. It doesn't mean that that doesn't happen. But there was this correlation between being popular and being bullied, which was not something that they expected going in. And the study wasn't designed to answer the question of why that is. It could be, they suspect it could be. So one hypothesis is that it's status competition. You know, so of course you're going to go after the kids with the high status because they're the ones you got to knock off their perch, you know. All right. Let's go for the number three. Scientists have created a computer vision system that can distinguish real versus faked expressions of pain much better than human subjects. This one also is science. And this one surprised me because...
Why?
Because I would think that humans should be really good at knowing whether another human is expressing pain or not. But they made a computer that was better than a human at facial pattern recognition. That doesn't surprise you?
Well, that's supposedly a big problem with doctors giving out pain meds, right? Like to junkies and stuff like that. I think people are pretty good at faking stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the conclusion, that you think that people are good at acting, right? I mean, people
acting.
Act in a very convincing way. Perhaps pain is particularly easy. But what the computer did, the visual recognition system was able to look at the dynamics of how they moved their face in, at a time frame that people just can't perceive. So like subtle things that are just, you know, you can't perceive, but the computer was able to dissect. Like, for example, one of the factors that emerged from this is that when people are faking pain, they open their mouth in a much more predictable or regular pattern. When they're really in pain, it's more unpredictable. It's less regular.
Hmm.
Now, when I was reading this, I was thinking about the Lie to Me TV show. You guys ever watch that?
Yeah, yeah.
Where like they videotape people in the interview and then they're looking for like all the kind of the corner of his mouth turns
micro up. Micro expressions.
Yeah, the micro expressions.
Which is pretty much based on bullshit.
Yeah.
Is it really?
Pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. But this study suggest that there may be something to that, you know, because that's basically what they're saying, is that the computer was able to pick up, you know, these very subtle aspects of the expressiveness that was. So here's the numbers are impressive too. I mean, like anything, it's one study. We'd like to see it replicated, but the people were able to know whether this is even after training. They actually did train the people to detect real versus fake pain. And after training, they were able to get 55% correct, which was not statistically different than chance. So people were essentially completely unable to tell who was in real pain and who was faking it. The computer system was able to get 85% accuracy.
Whoa.
Wow, I'm very surprised.
Yeah. So that's a pretty robust result, you know?
Yay, computers.
All right. Well, good job, guys. So the lesson here is don't recycle items that I chose last week. Okay. So, you know, it's prepped for Nexus and all that stuff. Right, let me break.
Yeah, whatever excuse helps you sleep.
that's the one I'm going with, okay?
Wait till next week.
Jay, give us a quote.
All right, this was a quote sent in by a listener named David Crooks from Honolulu and Atlanta. This quote was from a Forbes article that I read in researching my topic. The author of that article is named Emily Willingham. And the quote is, "Belief is also less than featherweight as evidence. Before method reined in the human tendency to motive-seeking madness, beliefs led us into all kinds of cul-de-sacs of thinking. Belief has no place in discussing the biological origins of a human condition." Emily Willingham!
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, belief is bad. I'm very anti-belief.
Hey guys, don't forget tickets are available for the 2014 Skeptical Conference. That's on May 31st this year. It's coming up at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center. And you want to learn more about it and see how you can register, go to skeptical2014.brownpapertickets.com.
And since we're talking about conferences, don't forget that The Amazing Meeting is coming up July 11th to 13th in Las Vegas, Nevada. The SGU will be there. We'll be live on stage. We will be doing the SGU dinner, which you can register for through the TAM registration site. We are doing a poker tournament this year, but the registration for that is going to be different. You're going to have to register on site. So don't look for that on the website.
So people can only register for that when they show up to the event, Steve?
Yeah, they can only register on site.
Oh, that's boy. Right. First come, first serve, man.
Yeah, that's right. And don't forget, you get a $25 discount when you use the registration code SGUTAM2014. Please use the code because it helps track our referrals to TAM. And also, you get a $25 discount.
Stick to the code.
Stick to the code. Right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Had nothing better to do.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.